Section 1. Listening. This section of the test has three parts. You will hear three recordings which you will listen to twice. While listening, answer the questions in the appropriate part of the test. Follow the instructions. When answering questions in the first and second parts, use the answer sheet labelled with a cross. When answering questions in the third part, use the answer sheet labelled with a pen. Now prepare the answer sheet labelled with a cross. Part 1. You'll hear Debbie Horsfield, a scriptwriter, talking about her professional and personal life. For the following statements 1 to 7, choose the correct answer A, B, C or D. There is always only one correct answer. Mark your answers on the answer sheet labelled with a cross. Now you have 2 minutes to read the tasks. Now listen to part 1.
You will hear Debbie Horsfield, a scriptwriter, talking about her professional and personal life. Debbie began her career in theater. Her first TV project was one of her plays for BBC Two. She's now best known for her BBC One salon drama, Cutting It, and for writing all three series of Poldark, a British-American drama television series in which the main protagonist returns home after the American Revolutionary War. Well, let's listen to Debbie Horsfield now, who will describe her own experience with film and theatre.
One thing I knew we got right from the start was the casting of Aidan Turner as Ross Poldark. He's just great, isn't he? I'd seen him in two other TV series, Desperate Romantics and Being Human. The first is located in the 19th century, and the second is a British supernatural drama television series with comic and horror features. Watching him, I spotted these little characteristics Aidan and Ross shared, a sort of restlessness, charisma and acting emotionally. When I was first approached about Poldark, my first thought was, have they definitely got the right person here? I'd never done anything like it before and had no idea what the rules were for adapting novels. But I read the first two books and thought, I'd really like to do this because the characters seemed to leap off the page. Then I read the books again and again. The biggest challenge was not having someone to turn to and listen to his comments or advice. But that's supposed to be my job after all. In fact, when I wrote my first draft of the first episode, I crammed in as much of Winston Graham's story as possible. Then I read it back and realised I'd made a huge mistake. It was terrible. I realised that I needed to get rid of everything in the book that wasn't directly related to Ross Poldark. I learned to be pretty systematic in this. It might sound strange, but I can't remember a time when I wasn't writing stories. I was the child who wanted to spend every second of every day creating adaptations of fairy stories, which I'd then talk my sister and brother into performing. Writing wasn't a profession that was taken seriously in our household. Dad had a greengrocer's shop and Mum stayed at home to look after us. I've always followed Write About What You Know, and my idea for cutting it came from my twin sisters Jeannie and Lynette. They had a hair salon and used to enter these big hairdressing competitions. Now, a hairdressing competition might not sound particularly exciting, but trust me, to this day, there's still some of the most dramatic things I've ever been to. The three of us had so much fun reliving all those memories. It never really occurred to me I could make the transition from theatre to TV, but boy did things change when that happened. My agent heard the BBC were looking for new writers, so he suggested my play, Out on the Floor, and that led to me being commissioned to write an episode of Crown Court. I remember going to rehearsals and seeing a group of famous actors in the canteen and thinking, oh my God, I wonder what they are doing here. Then the producer met me and said, now come and meet your cast. That really took me by surprise. There's a part of me in every character I write, even the ones that are deliberately unlikable. No matter what character it is, I have to get inside their head and see the world from their point of view. I think that's one of the things writers such as Kay Mellor and Sally Wainwright have in common. Even when you have a brilliant thriller like Happy Valley, first and foremost, it's the characters you're engaged with, isn't it?
Now listen again.
You will hear Debbie Horsfield, a scriptwriter, talking about her professional and personal life. Debbie began her career in theatre. Her first TV project was one of her plays for BBC Two. She's now best known for her BBC One salon drama, Cutting It, and for writing all three series of Poldark, a British-American drama television series in which the main protagonist returns home after the American Revolutionary War. Well, let's listen to Debbie Horsfield now, who will describe her own experience with film and theatre.
One thing I knew we got right from the start was the casting of Aidan Turner as Ross Poldark. He's just great, isn't he? I'd seen him in two other TV series, Desperate Romantics and Being Human. The first is located in the 19th century, and the second is a British supernatural drama television series with comic and horror features. Watching him, I spotted these little characteristics Aidan and Ross shared, a sort of restlessness, charisma and acting emotionally. When I was first approached about Poldark, my first thought was, have they definitely got the right person here? I'd never done anything like it before and had no idea what the rules were for adapting novels. But I read the first two books and thought, I'd really like to do this because the characters seemed to leap off the page. Then I read the books again and again. The biggest challenge was not having someone to turn to and listen to his comments or advice. But that's supposed to be my job after all. In fact, when I wrote my first draft of the first episode, I crammed in as much of Winston Graham's story as possible. Then I read it back and realised I'd made a huge mistake. It was terrible. I realised that I needed to get rid of everything in the book that wasn't directly related to Ross Poldark. I learned to be pretty systematic in this. It might sound strange, but I can't remember a time when I wasn't writing stories. I was the child who wanted to spend every second of every day creating adaptations of fairy stories, which I'd then talk my sister and brother into performing. Writing wasn't a profession that was taken seriously in our household. Dad had a greengrocer's shop and Mum stayed at home to look after us. I've always followed Write About What You Know, and my idea for cutting it came from my twin sisters, Jeannie and Lynette. They had a hair salon and used to enter these big hairdressing competitions. Now, a hairdressing competition might not sound particularly exciting, but trust me, to this day, there's still some of the most dramatic things I've ever been to. The three of us had so much fun reliving all those memories. It never really occurred to me I could make the transition from theatre to TV, but boy did things change when that happened. My agent heard the BBC were looking for new writers, so he suggested my play, Out on the Floor, and that led to me being commissioned to write an episode of Crown Court. I remember going to rehearsals and seeing a group of famous actors in the canteen and thinking, oh my God, I wonder what they are doing here. Then the producer met me and said, now come and meet your cast. That really took me by surprise. There's a part of me in every character I write, even the ones that are deliberately unlikable. No matter what character it is, I have to get inside their head and see the world from their point of view. I think that's one of the things writers such as Kay Mellor and Sally Wainwright have in common. Even when you have a brilliant thriller like Happy Valley, first and foremost, it's the characters you're engaged with, isn't it?
Now you have 30 more seconds to complete the tasks. Part 2. You will hear some facts from the life of Sidney Poitier, a renowned African-American actor. For questions 8 to 13, decide whether the statements are true, A, false, B, or whether the information was not given, C. Mark your answers on the answer sheet labelled with a cross. Now you have 2 minutes to read the tasks. Now listen to part two.
Actor Sidney Poitier's presence in film during the 1950s and 1960s opened up the possibility for bigger and better roles for African-American performers. Born on February 20, 1924, in Miami, Florida, but raised in the Bahamas, Sidney Poitier was the son of Reginald and Evelyn Poitier. His father was a tomato farmer, and the family was very poor. The family moved from the village of Cat Island to Nassau, the Bahamian capital, when Poitier was 11 years old, and it was there that he first experienced the magic of the movies. Poitier returned to Miami at the age of 15 to live with his older brother, Cyril. Poitier left for New York City at the age of 16, serving briefly in the army. He then worked as a dishwasher in a restaurant. Seeing an ad for actors in a newspaper, he went to a tryout at the American Negro Theater. Theater co-founder Frederick O'Neill became impatient with Poitier's Caribbean accent and poor reading skills. He came up on the stage, furious, and grabbed me by the scruff of my pants and my collar and marched me toward the door, Poitier told the Los Angeles Times. Poitier, determined to succeed, continued working in the restaurant, but listened to radio broadcasts in his spare time to improve his speaking. He later returned to the theater and was hired as a caretaker in exchange for acting lessons. Poitier served as an understudy, one who learns a performer's lines in case that performer is unable to perform, for actor-singer Harry Belafonte in a play called Days of Our Youth, and an appearance one night led to a small role in a production of the Greek comedy Lysistrata. On the opening night of the latter play, Poitier was so nervous that he delivered the wrong lines and ran off the stage. Still, his brief appearance so impressed critics that he ended up getting more work. Poitier made his film debut in the 1950 feature No Way Out, playing a doctor tormented by the racist brother of a man whose life he could not save. Poitier worked steadily throughout the 1950s, appearing in The Defiant Ones, in which Poitier and Tony Curtis play prison escapees who are chained together. Their struggle helps them look past their differences and learn to respect each other. In the 1960s, Poitier began to make his mark on American popular culture. Poitier took the part of an American serviceman in Germany in Lilies of the Field, 1963. This role earned him an Academy Award for Best Actor, making him the first African-American to earn this honor. In 1967, Poitier appeared in three hit movies. In To Sir, with Love, he played a schoolteacher, while In the Heat of the Night, he played Virgil Tibbs, a black detective from the North who helps solve a murder in a southern town and wins the respect of the prejudiced police chief there. In the comedy Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, also starring Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, Poitier's character is engaged to a white woman. The film was Hollywood's first love story between members of different races that did not end tragically. Poitier realized the importance of this role, and he said for the Times, "I suited their need. I was a pretty good actor. I believed in brotherhood, in a free society. I hated racism and segregation, and I was a symbol against those things." In 1972, Poitier co-starred with Belafonte in the Western Buck and the Preacher for Columbia Pictures. After an argument with the film's director, Poitier took over. Though he and Belafonte urged Columbia to hire another director, a studio official encouraged Poitier to finish the film himself. Poitier also directed the hit comedy Stir Crazy, 1980, as well as several other features.
Now listen again.
Actor Sidney Poitier's presence in film during the 1950s and 1960s opened up the possibility for bigger and better roles for African-American performers. Born on February 20, 1924, in Miami, Florida, but raised in the Bahamas, Sidney Poitier was the son of Reginald and Evelyn Poitier. His father was a tomato farmer, and the family was very poor. The family moved from the village of Cat Island to Nassau, the Bahamian capital, when Poitier was 11 years old, and it was there that he first experienced the magic of the movies. Poitier returned to Miami at the age of 15 to live with his older brother Cyril. Poitier left for New York City at the age of 16, serving briefly in the army. He then worked as a dishwasher in a restaurant. Seeing an ad for actors in a newspaper, he went to a tryout at the American Negro Theater. Theater co-founder Frederick O'Neill became impatient with Poitier's Caribbean accent and poor reading skills. He came up on the stage, furious, and grabbed me by the scruff of my pants and my collar and marched me toward the door, Poitier told the Los Angeles Times. Poitier, determined to succeed, continued working in the restaurant, but listened to radio broadcasts in his spare time to improve his speaking. He later returned to the theater and was hired as a caretaker in exchange for acting lessons. Poitier served as an understudy, one who learns a performer's lines in case that performer is unable to perform, for actor-singer Harry Belafonte in a play called Days of Our Youth, and an appearance one night led to a small role in a production of the Greek comedy Lysistrata. On the opening night of the latter play, Poitier was so nervous that he delivered the wrong lines and ran off the stage. Still, his brief appearance so impressed critics that he ended up getting more work. Poitier made his film debut in the 1950 feature No Way Out, playing a doctor tormented by the racist brother of a man whose life he could not save. Poitier worked steadily throughout the 1950s, appearing in The Defiant Ones, in which Poitier and Tony Curtis play prison escapees who are chained together. Their struggle helps them look past their differences and learn to respect each other. In the 1960s, Poitier began to make his mark on American popular culture. Poitier took the part of an American serviceman in Germany in Lilies of the Field, 1963. This role earned him an Academy Award for Best Actor, making him the first African-American to earn this honor. In 1967, Poitier appeared in three hit movies. In To Sir with Love, he played a schoolteacher, while In the Heat of the Night, he played Virgil Tibbs, a black detective from the North who helps solve a murder in a southern town and wins the respect of the prejudiced police chief there. In the comedy Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, also starring Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, Poitier's character is engaged to a white woman. The film was Hollywood's first love story between members of different races that did not end tragically. Poitier realized the importance of this role, and he said for the Times, "I suited their need. I was a pretty good actor. I believed in brotherhood, in a free society. I hated racism and segregation, and I was a symbol against those things." In 1972, Poitier co-starred with Belafonte in the Western Buck and the Preacher for Columbia Pictures. After an argument with the film's director, Poitier took over. Though he and Belafonte urged Columbia to hire another director, a studio official encouraged Poitier to finish the film himself. Poitier also directed the hit comedy Stir Crazy, 1980, as well as several other features.
Now you have 30 more seconds to complete the tasks. Now look at part three. For part three, you will need the answer sheet labelled with a pen. Please find and prepare it. Part three. You will hear a radio programme in which a psychologist gives tips on how to beat loneliness. The psychologist will describe six steps how to achieve this. Below, you can read summaries of this information numbered 14 to 20, which are in the wrong order. Indicate the order in which you hear the information by writing a number 1 to 6 next to the number that represents that information. Be careful, there is one extra summary. Put X next to the number that represents extra information. Write your answers on the answer sheet labelled with a pen. Now you have 2 minutes to read the tasks. Now listen to part three.
You will hear a radio program in which a psychologist gives tips how to beat loneliness and feel more connected to your surroundings. The psychologist will describe six steps how to achieve this.
Tip number one. Don't attempt to fill the empty spaces until you're certain where they are. You may have an active social life, yet feel painfully alone, so squeezing in more activities isn't the answer. When do you feel most lonely? Is it at work or while coming home to an empty house? What social contacts do you have and what are you missing? Perhaps you spend so much time with your family that close friendships have been allowed to disappear. Understand what's lacking before making changes. Tip number two. When turning acquaintances into friends, try to speak to them personally in real-life situations rather than knowing them via Facebook. Having someone around the corner means common interests and allows spontaneous get-togethers. Instead of using social media as a substitute for face-to-face contact, use them to find local people sharing the same values and interests. An app for new mums enabling them to connect with other new mums nearby is a nice example. The more you can develop a naturally occurring community, taking your dog to the same park, working at the same coffee shop with your laptop, the more you'll feel part of something. True friendships take time. Tip number three. Detach yourself from activities which don't reflect the real you. You could be so busy pleasing others that your own needs have got lost. If you feel out of place, don't rush off to the nearest exercise class or feel you need to accept every invitation. Think about what you loved as a child. What hobbies or interests speak to you now? When you get involved in something you love or start talking about something you believe in, close people are drawn to you and connections come naturally. Tip number four. Recognize and wrestle destructive thoughts. If you feel unconnected or unpopular, don't look for evidence of that and don't take people's reactions as rejection. The lonely can isolate themselves by repeating how different they feel from others. Get out of the habit of focusing on differences and find the common ground, whether it is having dogs or a shared hobby. Tip number five. Revitalize your old friendships, which can be less embarrassing than establishing new ones. Having experiences in common, someone who knew your parents, worked with you in your first job, can create a strong foundation for friendship. Many friendships drift apart because of circumstance and life transitions, and it need not mean that you were incompatible. You can just let these people know that you'd love to catch up, and it might be a good start. Be interested in how their lives are going now and keep expectations realistic. Don't expect to return immediately to old levels of intimacy. Take it slowly. Tip number six. Whether it's reading with children at your local primary school or volunteering at a hospital, there is a wealth of evidence that shows helping others is an excellent remedy for loneliness. Even without a formal commitment, be mindful and generous towards the people around you, such as helping an elderly neighbour or a struggling colleague. The act of being kind to someone helps us forget our isolation and focus on others, and at the same time helps us connect in a meaningful way. Now listen again.
You will hear a radio program in which a psychologist gives tips how to beat loneliness and feel more connected to your surroundings. The psychologist will describe six steps how to achieve this.
Tip number one. Don't attempt to fill the empty spaces until you're certain where they are. You may have an active social life, yet feel painfully alone, so squeezing in more activities isn't the answer. When do you feel most lonely? Is it at work or while coming home to an empty house? What social contacts do you have and what are you missing? Perhaps you spend so much time with your family that close friendships have been allowed to disappear. understand what's lacking before making changes. Tip number 2. When turning acquaintances into friends, try to speak to them personally in real-life situations rather than knowing them via Facebook. Having someone around the corner means common interests and allows spontaneous get-togethers. Instead of using social media as a substitute for face-to-face contact, use them to find local people sharing the same values and interests. An app for new mums enabling them to connect with other new mums nearby is a nice example. The more you can develop a naturally occurring community, taking your dog to the same park, working at the same coffee shop with your laptop, the more you'll feel part of something. True friendships take time. Tip number 3. Detach yourself from activities which don't reflect the real you. You could be so busy pleasing others that your own needs have got lost. If you feel out of place, don't rush off to the nearest exercise class or feel you need to accept every invitation. Think about what you loved as a child. What hobbies or interests speak to you now? When you get involved in something you love or start talking about something you believe in, close people are drawn to you and connections come naturally. Tip number 4. Recognize and wrestle destructive thoughts. If you feel unconnected or unpopular, don't look for evidence of that and don't take people's reactions as rejection. The lonely can isolate themselves by repeating how different they feel from others. Get out of the habit of focusing on differences and find the common ground, whether it is having dogs or a shared hobby. Tip number 5. Revitalize your old friendships, which can be less embarrassing than establishing new ones. Having experiences in common, someone who knew your parents, worked with you in your first job, can create a strong foundation for friendship. Many friendships drift apart because of circumstance and life transitions, and it need not mean that you were incompatible. You can just let these people know that you'd love to catch up, and it might be a good start. Be interested in how their lives are going now and keep expectations realistic. Don't expect to return immediately to old levels of intimacy. Take it slowly. Tip number 6. Whether it's reading with children at your local primary school or volunteering at a hospital, there is a wealth of evidence that shows helping others is an excellent remedy for loneliness. Even without a formal commitment, be mindful and generous towards the people around you, such as helping an elderly neighbour or a struggling colleague. The act of being kind to someone helps us forget our isolation and focus on others, and at the same time helps us connect in a meaningful way. Now you have 30 more seconds to complete the tasks. The listening section is now over. Please stop working on this section. Now go on to the next sections of the test.